Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, September 18th. I'm Ray Graff. Yes, new and exciting radio horizons ahead. It's Pets and Vets today. Ron Scharf is here from the Animal Hospital of Niskayuna. You got a question about your kitty cat or your dog? Well, let's hear them. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Pets and Vets today. You can email us if you wish at voxpop@wamc.org. Just try to give us enough detail about your animal and the issue, age and sex and whatnot, but not too long because then it takes too long to read. But the number, that always works, 800-348-2551, dogs, cats, maybe the odd ferret. Dr. Ron Scharf, your calls coming up on Vox Pop after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff, Pets and Vets today, here to take your calls as Dr. Ron Scharf from the Animal Hospital of Niskayuna, New York. Dr. Scharf is a 1985 grad of the Veterinary College at Cornell and has extensive background in conventional veterinary medicine. Oh, a long day already. Number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Now, I say this often, and I am not employing hyperbole here. It is best to get your place in line early. These lines will get loaded up fast. We won't get to all the calls. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Tweet us if you wish at WAMCVoxPop or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Ron Scharf, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Ray. It's always great being here. You're such a great host in particular, and I always enjoy my time here. Thank you.
How's summer?
Summer was great.
Still, don't say was. There's still a couple days left, right?
Well, you know, that air feels so nice and crisp.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful fall day, even though fall doesn't start for, 3 days or something?
Yeah.
But I think it's lovely out there. So I'm
good.
Sorry, but I'll use was.
All right, fair enough. Well, you had mentioned before we started about taurine and heart ailments in dogs. This is something I know nothing of.
Yes. So this is only something that has been discovered in the last year or so. You had mentioned my background, that I was a 1985 graduate of Cornell.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give a shout out to a classmate of mine who became a veterinary nutritionist. Her name is Lisa Freeman, and she was at Tufts and discovered that some dogs are getting heart problems as a result of a lack of an amino acid in their diet called taurine.
Ah.
That's T-A-U-R-I-N-E.
Right.
And as the months have gone by, we've learned more and more, though we still don't know the bottom line. But we did see some patterns. And at first, the FDA was in on it. They put out some notices, some bulletins. And at first, the pattern was that it's not all dogs that are getting it. But first, they were looking at what were called the BEG foods, B-E-G. That stands for B is boutique foods. That's these companies that maybe just sprang up in the last year or two. They got a special product. Maybe it's organic, free range, non-GMO, whatever it is.
Right.
But they don't have the track record or the reputation that a more established company has, number one.
Okay.
Number two, the E of the BEG is exotic ingredients. So that's for your people whose dogs might be having a food allergy, and one of the ways that you could try to avoid a problem is to give them a protein source that they have never been exposed to. So you're looking at things like kangaroo or whatever. That's the exotic ingredients part. The G, most people will be interested to hear, stands for grain-free. Now, it doesn't mean that all grain-free foods cause dogs to have taurine deficiencies, which cause heart problems, which is called, by the way, a dilated cardiomyopathy.
Mm-hmm.
However, there was a correlation. It wasn't causation. It was correlation. And furthermore, the four ingredients that were most correlated with the dog having a problem were peas, potatoes, lentils, and legumes.
No, interesting.
So if any of those four were in the top five ingredients on the food label, it would be foods that I would recommend avoiding. Now, at the end of June, the FDA came out with another notice that listed the 16 most common brands that were implicated.
Okay.
And some of them are top shelf brands. It's not a quality thing. And that's why I think that we don't know everything about it. I think there's probably genetics involved. How come only some dogs get the problem and not others? However, I would avoid grain-free products personally. If I had a dog that I was caring about, I would think twice, put it that way, before being complacent about keeping them on a diet, which may or may not lead to or contribute to having a heart problem. So you particularly want to watch for dogs that have a murmur or an arrhythmia or are showing any symptoms of a heart problem, like which could start as a soft cough. It could go into a exercise intolerance, meaning they get winded too easy from a small amount of exertion.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, as it progresses, it could actually give difficulty breathing. Like a person with a heart problem, you can be needing, you have to put effort into getting your air in. So you're recruiting abdominal muscles and your kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things that you want to watch out for with heart disease in general, cardiomyopathy in particular. Talk to your vet. Look at the foods. Keep on touch. There's my classmate from my Cornell class of 85. His name is Lisa Freeman, and she has a blog. So her name is spelled F-R-E-E-M-A-N. So if you want to just Google Lisa Freeman, you know, taurine blog or whatever, you can get more information from at least one unimpeachable source. And that's
well, all
the deal.
Sources could be impeachable, right?
Well, we can impeach. That's been in the news a lot lately, but I'm thinking Lisa is not one of them.
All right, but however, science is not complete on this.
Absolutely right. We're always learning. That's one of the great things I love about my profession is that you never know everything. No one ever knows everything, and it is incumbent upon good practitioners to always keep up with the reading, with the research, with the literature to make sure that you're practicing best practices. So for sure, that's definitely the case.
Dr. Ron Scharf is our guest today on Pets and Vets. Let's take a couple of calls before the first break. 800-348-2551, the number. Started off with Michelle in Mount Tremper. Michelle.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. And interestingly enough, my question is about cardio.
Oh.
I have a 12-year-old Chihuahua. He's had a stage 3 heart murmur literally probably for the last 5 or 6 years. My vet wasn't concerned about it. He's very, very active. He occasionally has a very minor seizure. But my question to you, doctor, is I noticed this summer when, and he is 12 years old, so he's getting old, when he was running around, he likes to chase the frisbee and the ball. On his exhale, he had a very loud exhale, and he seems to be reverse sneezing. At least that's what I thought it was. And now after I had him checked, my vet said, well, maybe the first thing we should do is get an x-ray. And I'm not pitting you against my vet, but I'm just wondering, is that enough? Should I just go straight? And I don't have unlimited money, but I want to take care of him. I'm wondering if I should go straight to a cardiologist instead of having, like, a general practitioner look at a sonogram in my regular vet's office. And
well,
thank you for taking
that. That is a great question, Michelle. And what I tell my clients, if I, say, hear a murmur for the first time on a dog that's, say, 12 years old, and all of a sudden they have a murmur, that gets my attention more than a murmur that's been there for many years and nothing clinical has shown up. So what I'll do is I'll say that the gold standard is going to a cardiologist, okay? However, that's not to say that your GP can't get some preliminary data first. And so what I'll recommend is most vets are equipped to do a blood pressure. So I would definitely get a blood pressure. And the next thing is a chest x-ray to get a baseline idea. How big is the heart? What's the shape of the heart? Because a lot of heart problems, Michelle, will show up on an x-ray. And also it tells you that there's no obvious fluid accumulation. If that pump is breaking down, you can start backing up and get some fluid buildup, pulmonary edema, it's called.
Mm.
And then the last thing, Michelle, there was a blood test now called a BNP. So this BNP, so or pro-BNP, and that is an indication of whether the heart muscle fibers are undergoing more stretch than they ought to be. And it is I wouldn't say crude indicator, but it's a helpful way to look into a heart problem. And I give people the option when I get my clients, I'll say, listen, we could start off here and get this baseline information, then go to a cardiologist. Some people don't want to go to a specialist, but if I find out that the BP is okay, the chest x-ray shows a normal shape and size of a heart, and that BNP is not too high, well, then I'm concerned, but I'm less concerned that it's an emergency. And at that point, maybe you could hold off unless and until the dog shows symptoms.
All right, Michelle, we have to take a break. Thank you for the call. Dr. Ron Scharf is our guest. It's Pets and Vets today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number, and we will be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Pets and Vets today. Dr. Ron Scharf is our guest. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Doc, two emails here, and then we'll jump back to the phones. This one's from KB. Subject heading, canine torn ACL. My three-year-old mixed female pooch has been diagnosed with a torn ACL in her left hind leg. What is the prognosis for recovery without expensive surgery? I am very poor. And that's from KB.
So the prognosis is not great without the surgery because the ACL, KB, is a major stabilizer of the knee, which we call in an animal, we call a stifle, by the way. And the smaller the animal, the less bad the consequences may be. In other words, if it was a cat, and cats don't really get torn ACLs that much, but cats are very forgiving on musculoskeletal problems, they're so light on their feet, etc. So the prognosis for a tiny animal that's light would be less bad than the prognosis for a big animal. So you have a three-year-old mixed breed, and I don't know how big that is. So the smaller she is, the better. There are anti-inflammatories. There's acupuncture, which I use a lot to relieve discomfort. There's glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate. There's adequate. There are a lot of different things that can be done to alleviate discomfort, but almost none of them are lending extra stabilization to that joint. There are braces that can be worn. They're probably better than nothing. They're on the inconvenient side. However, that would be the next best thing, to get a brace if a surgery is totally out of the question.
All right. This one is from Christine. Subject heading, great show, Ray, as always. Well, Christine, we still have 38 minutes to screw it up. This one says, Dr. Scharf, do you have any thoughts about the recent reports of the statistics of incidents of veterinarians and suicide? And that's from Christine in Watervliet. I have not heard about that one.
Okay, so yes, I have heard of the recent reports, and I have heard of it going back several years now, actually, within the veterinary community itself. We're talking about that. And for the last, I'd say, at least 5 or 6 years, there have been articles around, and they're addressing quality of life issues, how to establish a good work-life balance, and how to address what is called compassion fatigue. So in other words, you get these animals, they're sick, and the families are very concerned. They love their animal. The animal's a part of the family. They come in, maybe it's something that's treatable, maybe it's something that's less treatable, but any self-respecting veterinarian who loves what they do can't be a robot about that. You can't not get emotionally involved. These are clients. You fortunately, in many cases, have developed a very strong relationship with them. There's a bond. You're being trusted to take care of their animal. Their animal means a lot to them. And so it is very hard to avoid this compassion fatigue. And all of us have to develop our own stress responses. And there are ways to do it, things that you've heard of, you know, getting exercise, getting enough sleep, you know, enjoying your friends, your family, etc. But it is a brutal and very demanding profession. You know, a lot of people just, I've always wanted to be a vet, you know, I've wanted to be a vet since I was a kid, that kind of thing, and it's great. But people that are saying that are thinking about all the great stuff. I'm just petting dogs, I'm petting cats, I'm throwing a ball for a dog, I'm throwing, you know, I'm hanging out, I love animals, yeah. I'm with animals. But they don't realize that there are many, many stressful situations, and you just feel bad for an animal that, say, has something that cannot be totally cured, or you feel bad, you see that they're in pain, you see that their owners are in pain. And so there are a lot of downsides. There's also the money aspect. I mean, unless you have pet health insurance, which I totally recommend, everything's out of pocket. And a lot of people are like the previous email that they just can't afford a surgery. Mm-hmm. That's expensive. It's expensive stuff. It's a big chunk of change. So it is a very stressful day. I have some 12-hour days. Mm. I don't even get a five-minute break. I just keep them going straight through.
Well, you should try radio.
I should try radio.
Yeah, a lot of breaks. So, you sit around.
You know, you're doing these appointments. You know, one takes longer than you budgeted, so now you're behind. And now the next one comes in, they take longer. So you got the stress from the time crunch, number one. Number two, it's the sickness, the compassion fatigue. Number three, it's the people maybe not being able to pay or afford taking care of their animal. Number four, diseases or conditions that you can't help. Number five, I mean, the list goes on and on.
Okay.
And at the end of a long day, you're exhausted. You're wiped out. It's not just the vet. It's the staff. The staff are dealing with all these people, and it's just, I don't want to say that I don't have any regrets about doing what I do, but I am totally unsurprised, Christine, to hear about these reports.
Okay.
It's totally understandable.
You're okay, though?
At the moment, I'm perfect. Okay. Beautiful fall day like this.
Get a glass of water or anything?
I think it'll last a while because there's gorgeous fall weather out there.
All right.
So I think for now, I'm great.
All right.
No, I've never had, like I said, I never had any regrets about doing it. I love what I do, and that's it.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Mike in Bloomingburg. Mike, you're on.
Hey there, fellas. How you doing?
Good.
Hi, Mike.
Just had a question. It's kind of a twofer. One about dieting for my cat and his behavior in the litter box. One, we changed his food from dry food to wet food. And the question is, is that going to affect the smell that's coming out of that litter box? Because it's pretty foul.
Oh, thanks.
The answer is yes. I mean, it depends upon what the ingredients are and whether or not there are ingredients, Mike, that maybe the cat's digestive tract doesn't have as easy a time dealing with as other ingredients. Number one, you could try different foods. Now, when you switch around foods, you always want to do it gradually. You know, take 5 days to let them get used to the new food. I do applaud your change into canned food. I don't know why, but what I tell my clients, Mike, is that other than the convenience factor, canned food is better than dry food in all respects, all respect, including dental, including urinary tract, including that there's not filler in there like there is in the dry foods. I don't begrudge anyone that's feeding dry food. I feed my animals some dry food as well. But the biggest positive about dry food is the convenience, and that's it. So can it change the smell? Yes, but it's not necessarily because you went from dry to canned. It could be an ingredient in the can that is causing it, would be my best bet.
Mm.
All right. Well, on the backside of that, after the eating, he has to go to the litter box. He's like a tornado in there, just scratching at the walls of it, throwing the litter all out of the pan and all that. Is there anything that we're doing wrong? Maybe filling the pan too much or not enough? And then afterwards, he gets out and just does this guttural meow, like, you know,
tremendous.
Like that. You know, I'm just wondering if that's a behavioral thing, if we can change that, or if it's something that we're doing.
How old's the cat, Mike?
How old is the cat, Mike?
He's about 2 years old.
Okay.
Three?
Okay. Two.
Okay.
Yeah.
Has he been doing it all his life, or is this something new, Mike?
Yeah, pretty much all his life.
Okay. So it could be personality, but it could also be that he doesn't like the litter. Okay, there are definite what they call substrate preferences that cats have. And for instance, a lot of these cats are scented. Most cats hate that. Okay, so people like the scent because it'll cover that bad smell.
Yeah.
But a lot of cats are insulted by that smell, and they'll do everything they can to avoid that litter box. So they might go toward the litter box and do the business just outside the litter box or whatever. So one thing I would wonder about, Mike, is a substrate preference, number one. Number two, maybe there's something about the box they don't like. Like some cats, if they're in a covered box and they don't like it, maybe they're claustrophobic or it increases the smell for them.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll look for alternatives. Some cats, not yours, yours is only two, but some older cats with arthritis and the wall of the litter box is too high, so that might provide an impediment, not an impediment, but a kind of an obstacle to getting in there. So I would change the litter, Mike. That would be the first thing I would do. I would try to get a clumping litter that is unscented and go from there. See what that does for them. And I'm thinking that I'd put my best money in this situation on it's the litter that he doesn't like or he's quirky.
Okay.
You know, maybe it's a personality.
You know, we can't get through one of these shows without a question about cat poop. Let's go to Mike in Cambridge. Mike, you're on.
Hey, thanks, guys. Hey, my cat's about 6 years old, and it goes in and out. Occasionally brings me back a mouse or a bird or a rabbit, something like that. But just today, I noticed for the very first time that it rubbed its backside on the carpet. And I was wondering what that was all about and if I should be concerned about it, what I should do.
If you don't see it again, I might not worry about it, Mike. But if you do see it again, I would take the cat in to see the vet, see if it's an anal sac problem. Sometimes they have a scent gland on their in their hiney. And for a dog, that's what causes dogs, when they greet each other, to go to the back end. They're smelling this scent gland. It's a pheromone. It's chemical communication.
Yeah.
Cats have them, too, but they're way less problematic in cats. It's not unusual in dogs to need them empty. You know, they're not emptying when they ought to, which is generally when they bear down, you know, like when they defecate.
Mm.
Well, cats could conceivably have an anal sac problem, number one, or any other problem, Mike, that's in that anal area. There's also sometimes when an animal gets allergic and it's itchy and that itch can localize wherever on the body it wants to. Well, I know in dogs that sometimes can be the hiney, the hind end. I've never seen an allergic cat with a hind end problem, but when they're scooting, when they're rubbing that backside, we call it scooting, it's either anal sac or allergy or something in the back end that's causing them either discomfort or itch. So I take them into the vet, see what's going on.
All right. Questioning my career choices. Let's go to Emily in Shelburne Falls. Emily, you're on.
Hi. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
You always give me a chuckle. I have to be serious now.
Okay.
Because this is, a problem.
All right.
My daughter has a cat. I'm going to call her Helen, which is her name. And she's probably 4 or 5 years old. And she was their first animal in New York City 5 years ago, let's say. Then they got another little kitten, a male. And she tolerated him. And then they moved to Maine 2 years ago, and a year ago got a puppy, a little Shih Tzu, sorry. And over the last year since they have the puppy or the transition, the first cat is now defecating and urinating outside of her box to the point where it's very dismaying to my daughter. And so this weekend, we are going to try a test and see if Helen will be able to live with my husband and I. We don't have any other pets. And my daughter has a child who's 7 now, so he was like 4 when he had the first cat. My question to you is, her vet told her that the house that Helen was living in, her house, was not appropriate for her. So she has taken her to the vet where she lives in Portland, and the vet has also put her on anti-anxiety medication. And my daughter just totally cleaned the house the other day, and the cat just peed on the rug.
Ouch.
You know, so she's just, you know, in tears. My daughter is in tears about all of this, but it's her son's, you know, cuddly pet too. But now he has the puppy, so it's not as important. So, what do you think of this plan of us taking on this project? And do you think we can, as my daughter relays it to her son, retrain Helen to pee in the box?
I think it's a great idea, Emily, because the most likely
really.
Part- Yes, because the most likely possibility is that Helen stressed from the second cat as well as the dog. And a lot of cats that are stressed can get these urinary tract problems. And as a matter of fact, what we in the veterinary field call feline lower urinary tract disease, FLUTD. That's these cats with bladder problems, and they get, you know, it hurts them to pee, and they think there's still more in
right.
there.
She, so they, yeah, she has had yeah. a urinary so, tract infection as
okay.
well.
We're not even calling yeah. it, Emily, a urinary tract infection at all. That term goes back about 10 or 15 years because they're not all infections. That's why we went to
that's
the FL.
What the vet called it. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
No problem.
You,
no problem.
That's what her vet called it. So.
Well, that's fine.
It could
that's,
be,
that's, a,
right?
that's the vernacular. That's okay. that's the word that okay. someone would understand. Like
okay.
if I tell you feline lower urinary tract disease, it's a mouthful, first of all. Second of all, it doesn't. It's not as accessible
right.
to the human brain. It's just saying UTI, you know. So anyway, the
okay.
other thing, Emily, that has been getting more and more traction in the last 5 or 10 years is that many, and maybe even most, cats with feline lower urinary tract disease have something called feline interstitial cystitis, FIC. And that condition, there are some women that have an interstitial cystitis, which has a connection with the brain. So a lot of these women go on antidepressants. So and
uh-huh.
see some amelioration in their symptoms. So we are doing that. We're starting to go down that direction with cats, that they get a lot of these bladder problems secondary to a stressful circumstance. And cats are more solitary than dogs. So they're not crazy about mm-hmm. being in a crowd. So first they get the other cat, then they get the dog. So it might be a stress thing that led to an FIC, a feline
uh-huh.
interstitial cystitis. And there are foods that are generally helpful as well. However, changing the environment might be the end all and the be all as far as Helen, because if it is due to the other cat and the dog that she has developed this, well, all of a sudden she's with you and your husband and she doesn't have to deal with that those other animals. That might be all you
hey.
Need, unless there's an interstitial cystitis which persists. You know, like just because they're changing their environment doesn't mean a physical condition
right.
is immediately resolved. So you'd have to play it by ear. But I think it's if you can handle it, I think that that's a very good thing to do. And then hopefully you'd be able to get the cat off the anti-anxiety, because if there's no anxiety stimulus anymore, then she wouldn't need the
right.
medication.
All right, Emily, thank you for the call. Now let's go over to Nancy in Wilton. Nancy, you're on with Dr. Ron Scharf.
Okay. Hi, thank you for taking my call. I took on the care of a cat that was my son's, who was obviously in great distress. And they have two little ones, and wife is in college. They just, their life was too busy to deal with them. So I took him on. I took him to my vet, and there's several different vets in the clinic where I go. Most of them said he has a growth on his liver and that he's terminal, and to just, you know, keep him comfortable. The fellow who owns the practice at that time said, no, he has an enlarged liver. The prognosis still wasn't all that great. What I need to know, he was supposed to be dead last Christmas, and he has done blazingly well. Put him on some good food and get some direct sunlight, and you know, I just lavish all the care I can on him, and he's done wonderful. Now he's not. Now he's slowed down. He acts like his vision is becoming blurry. Every once in a while he'll throw up, but just, you know, kind of like bile. And I went back to the vet and I said, can I have some prednisone? Because we tried that right away when I first got him, and it worked really good to just kind of give him a bolt. And she wasn't real crazy about the idea, you know, kind of like, well, why are you, you know, extending this suffering? And right now he's sitting on this lounge chair and he's sleeping, but he has a difficult time sleeping. And so I've got this bottle that I paid for, and I'm thinking, and my husband said it last night too, are you doing this for yourself? Or are you doing it for him?
A bottle of what?
Must, It's he has to take liquid, so it's liquid prednisone.
Oh, so you got the prednisone. Okay.
Yeah, so I have the prednisone, and my husband's basically saying, you know, are you treating him with this? I mean, obviously, I'm just going to extend his life. But do you come up to, with those ethical kind of questions in your practice? Because I have a real hard time with letting pets go.
Only all the time. So how old's the cat, Nancy? Any idea?
He must be around 11 or 12.
Okay. And is he doing well on the prednisone?
I haven't started. Prednisone I did the first time. He bounced back. That's I started that when I first got him last year, and he just bounced right back and seemed to. I mean, everything though changed, so his life improved.
So I'll tell you something, Nancy. A few things. First of all, in my veterinary education at Cornell. I was taught to have a healthy paranoia about the use of corticosteroids like prednisone, unless they have a condition which is has been diagnosed that indicates that as a treatment. Okay, but the problem is that oftentimes prednisone can make anything look better, but it is not doing a good thing for the animal because internally their organs might be suffering as a result of being on long-term pred. So I've always been personally, I am also hesitant about dispensing pred when I don't know what the diagnosis is firmly. But that having been said, there are certain liver conditions that might call for the use of prednisone, in which case, by all means, you use it. Now, if it were me or my animal with a liver problem that got better with prednisone and the prednisone was an appropriate medication, I don't want to be put to sleep. I would take the prednisone personally or my animal, my dog, my cat. But on the other thing that I learned at Cornell, well, it was more than two things, but on the other end of the spectrum, I was taught that never let a patient die without having had the benefit of prednisone. Okay, so in other words, if you're at the end of your rope, if there's nothing else that you could do or can afford, and it's either the animal gets better or you be euthanized, well then yes, under those circumstances, what do you got to lose as far as using prednisone on something that you don't have a firm diagnosis that indicates that is the proper medication? So if he's doing well on the prednisone, yeah, I would definitely do it. It would be better, Nancy, ideally, to get a diagnosis. And once you start an animal on pred, you're tying the hands of the diagnostics because the pred will change the clinical picture. And if you're getting a biopsy, the tissue that you're looking at may have been changed as a result of having been on that medication. So ideally, Nancy, you get a needle biopsy of that liver to find out what is going on. And if it's something that's autoimmune or something that would indicate prednisone, then by all means, give them the pred. If you can't afford or decide that you don't want to be invasive or aggressive in order to get a diagnosis with a needle biopsy, well, then use the pred if there are no other no other things that you could do for the cat. So that's a deal.
Nancy, thanks for the call. We are late for a break here. Dr. Ron Scharf is our guest. It's Pets and Vets. 800-348-2551 is the number. We will be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ron Scharf, the guest today. Pets and Vets is the topic. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's go back to the phones. Barbara in Ghent. Barbara, you're next.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have an older cat who is diabetic and managed well with insulin, but recently has been urinating outside of the box. Nothing about our environment has changed. I have an appointment to get her sugar levels checked, but I was just wondering, and I also looked on the internet and it indicated that there is a link with diabetic cats urinating outside of the box. And that made me curious, just wondering, what is it about a diabetic cat that would want them to urinate outside of a box?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Oh, yeah. That's a good question, Barbara. And there are two possible reasons. Number one, if a cat's diabetic, they're drinking more water than normal. If they're drinking more water than normal, they're peeing more than normal. If they're peeing more than normal, then the box is getting wetter than normal. Cats are fastidious. If their box is wetter than they are used to, they will say, I'm not going in there. I'm going to go near there, but I'm not going in there because it needs to be cleaned out more often because they're diabetic. Possibility one. Possibility two. There is also a correlation, Barbara, in diabetic animals with getting urinary tract infections because, think of it, there's sugar in the urine. Bacteria love sugar, okay? So diabetic cats get way more UTIs than the general population. Now, this is one of the few times I'll use that term, UTI. The previous caller, we were talking about a feline lower urinary tract disease in cats is the more common. But in this case, it actually is a UTI. It's an infection. It's a bacterial infection. So all you got to do is a urinalysis to see if that exists. And I would say, as a diabetic, you want to do a urinalysis twice a year, even if there are no symptoms, because it's not unusual for a diabetic cat to get it. So it's one of those two things. Clean the box more often, do a urinalysis, get the cat on antibiotics. I'm assuming that that would be a good thing to do. And I'm betting that that would help your problem, Barbara.
Barbara, thanks for the call. Now to Donna in Avril Park. Hello, Donna.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My sister, who has limited funds, has an 8 or 9 year old cat. He was a rescue. He's a tuxedo, and appears to be in very good health. He's active, affectionate, has no issues, physical issues to see. Other than, as you say, you can't have a cat discussion without talking about the litter box.
Right.
His bowel movements are loose, very loose. And he doesn't seem to be suffering in any way other than the fact that his bowel movements are loose. So the question is, what can she do to help, right?
Okay.
And also, I would say to her that I have a jar of total biotics, the probiotic.
Okay.
From the vet.
Hang on,
that
Donna.
I was going to give to her.
Hey, Donna.
But is there anything else that she can do?
Okay, I think we have the gist. Hey, Donna, I just want to tell you, you're probably on speakerphone. You're dropping in and out. It sounds like a World War II field broadcast, but we got the gist. Loose bowels, kitty cat, yada yada yada. Dr. Scharf,
how long have our bowel movements been loose, Donna? Your sister's cat, is this a week, a year, all its life? What are we talking
about? Oh, probably a year at least.
Okay, and how old's the cat? Oh, 8, 9
years old. Oh, 9 years
old. Okay. So the first thing you do is check a stool sample to make sure there's no parasites. The second thing you do.
Okay, he's been an inside cat always.
Doesn't matter. You always check for parasites.
Okay.
Number one. Number two, you do dietary trials. The first thing that you use is a low-residue, low-fat food, and you feed small amounts at a time to see whether or not the low-fat food has a good effect on the poop. Number three, if the low-fat or low-residue food that you've used for, say, a couple weeks does not help, then you think about the possibility that he has a food allergy or food intolerance. So that means you use a different kind of food. Now, it is also possible he's got a physical problem, like an inflammatory bowel disease, okay? Some of your milder inflammatory bowel diseases could respond to a hypoallergenic food. So you're back to a food trial, okay? But in order to do that, you're not talking just doing it for a day or two or even a week or two, but keeping the cat on it. If there's a food allergy, it sometimes can take a while to let their intestinal mucosa, breathe a sigh of relief, so to speak. But there are other things that it could be also which might require diagnostics. So you do the stool sample, first of all, diagnostic. Then you do the food trials, okay? Then if the food trials don't work, you start gathering information such as blood tests and x-rays, okay? Now, you were saying about the rice. Yes. an example of a low-fat food, a low-residue food, would be boiling up some chicken. When you boil it, you skim off the fat. That's truly low-fat or no-fat food. And you make some white rice, not minute rice, not brown rice. You give the cat a small amount, which means a teaspoon. Then an hour or two later, you give another teaspoon or two. Then another couple, 3 hours later, you give 3 or 4 teaspoons. So what you're doing is you're providing nutrition that is the least challenging for the digestive tract to deal with. Okay? If you see that those stools start firming up, it gives you an information which direction to go in. If you don't see any improvement, well, now you're thinking about the possibility of a food allergy or a food intolerance or something physical such as what's called infiltrative disease. That's either inflammatory bowel disease or lymphoma. The next thing you had mentioned, I think in the din, I heard the word probiotics. It's a great idea. The probiotics are giving the good bacteria that all of us depend upon to do good digesting. So it's totally a good idea to use probiotics. They are thousands of times stronger than yogurt. You know, everyone knows about yogurt.
Yeah.
But yogurt's got good bacteria in the order of a few million. Probiotics have good bacteria in the order of 10 billion.
Is that so too much?
Big difference. Not too much.
Okay.
Not too much. So there are various things you could do, Donna, depending upon, you know, if the money's limited, at least the dietary trials are no big deal. One fecal is no big deal. Sometimes some of these nonspecific enterituses, that's inflammation of the small intestine, will respond to some penicillin. You know, I have an injectable penicillin that lasts 5 days in the system. So one shot, as a cat person, it's nice to not have to orally medicate your cat.
Yeah.
You could just try one of these long-acting penicillin injections, just to, if nothing else, then as a diagnostic thing. In other words, did it help? Because that's going to have an effect on the gut biome, what you call the biome as well. Short of that, Donna, everything else costs money. But I think that the dietary trials might do the job. If the
okay.
cat's acting fine, it's not likely that it's a horrible thing. It is a good possibility that making sure there's no parasites and doing the dietary trials could do the job for your sister's cat.
I've had cats all my life, and I would never expect a cat to eat rice. Are you going to feed a teaspoon of rice to a cat?
Well, you're mixing it with boiled chicken, a boiled hamburger, or something like that.
I thought you
Absolutely.
Said straight spoonful of rice.
No, no, I'm talking meat.
Okay.
And then rice is the carb. That's the bulk.
Okay.
You know?
All right. So. Let's go back to the phones. And Jenny, who is driving in Massachusetts. Be safe, Jenny. You're on. Or maybe you're
was
not.
Was driving in Massachusetts.
Hello, Jenny. Are you still there? Are you on the side of the road fixing a flat? Hello? Okay. Well, Jenny waited a long time, and now she's going to be really upset. And you can blame Dr. Scharf for Jenny.
My fault.
Tara in Gilson, you're on.
Hi. Okay, I have called you before. I'm not going to cry. I have a 16-year-old Shih Tzu, roundabout age. He's a rescue, so we're guesstimating that. We're talking about end-of-life care at this point, trying to keep him comfortable. His main problems, he's blind. He's now seems to be unable to hear. We do have a problem with cysts in his ears. We've had a few removed. His current doctor doesn't think anything will be resolved unless we do, like, a whole middle ear removal, which he's not a candidate for because of his age and health. I have him on a pain treatment. He seems pretty happy. So how long should I wait? And secondary, what is your opinion of CBD oil treatment?
Okay.
All right.
So great questions, Tara. I'm sorry that your Shih Tzu is getting old. It's a male or a female?
You know, he's a male. We've rescued him. We've given him a great life.
Oh, yeah.
He's had so many food allergy issues, anxiety issues. We've made him as happy as he could. And I just want to keep that going, you know?
Well, it sounds like you did a great job. Number one. Number two, blindness and deafness does not bother animals.
What?
Unless the blindness is due to a disease like glaucoma or you know, cataracts that have leaked out lens protein, just blindness from age, they're not like us, okay? They're not thinking, oh,
yeah.
I used to be able to see and now I can't. Woe is me. They're thinking, here's our circumstances. Let's deal with it. Now, the only
thing. Yeah, it's more adapting.
Yeah, they adapt. But you don't want to be changing your furniture around a lot, number one. Number two, mm-hmm. when they're old and they're blind-ish and they're deaf, okay, they tend to be enveloped in their own cocoon, insulated from the world, and may be easier to get underfoot. And then someone steps on their tail. And so sometimes they get scared of being hurt and they can get snappy. So that may or may not be the case with your guy. Yeah. However, it is something that I warn people about when they have these old blind and deaf dogs to be careful about. But otherwise, I haven't heard anything other than sis and ears. Unless the ears are hurting, if he's happy, I think I would not start thinking about anything because he's happy, okay? As far as the CBD.
I've managed the pain treatment. It has been an issue with him being in pain, but we do have him on a tramadol substance that I've gotten the dose right and the time to give it to him.
Excellent.
And he does have bad days. I'm not going to make it sound like he's got a great outlook. He does have very bad days. So I have been including a CBD treatment. And I mean, my vet wasn't too.
All right. Well, let's touch on the CBD treatment and then we'll have to try to get to Jenny who is back on the line.
So the CBD thing, first of all, Tara, I didn't even talk about it until recently when it became legalized to be used in New York State. I personally was scared that if the DEA found out about that I was using a Schedule I substance, that my license would be endangered. I'm concerned about that kind of thing. So now
I get it. I mean,
let
me tell you, it's hard enough to get them the tramadol, so I can imagine how that was.
I can't, because of that, because of the timing, it's only been this year, I can't say that I've had a lot of experience, but I have heard anecdotally that many animals feel better on it, either for pain management or certain anxieties, or if they don't sleep well, or even seizure disorders. Those are the two or the three major indications for CBD that we know of. And what you do is you start at a low dose. I think it's a couple times a day, and it may be the case that your boy gets better from that.
All right, let's quickly. Now, we only have 40 seconds for Jenny in Massachusetts, who is back. Jenny, I'm sorry, we only have seconds for you.
I will be so fast. My dog had, thank you. My dog has just finished 4 months of heartworm treatment and severely restricted exercise, as you're supposed to do. We're up with the 4 months. Can I just, she's 10 months old. Can I let her puppy play and run? Do I need to condition her? You know, what? How do I get her back to exercise?
Okay. Yeah. So, great question. I think that the answer is, without asking you a ton of questions, because we're running out of time, I like to know who I'm talking about, what the history is, etc. But from just what I know, that we are 4 months down the road after the heartworm treatment, I would let that dog have more and more exercise little by little. So get that dog back in shape gradually. And over the course of a month, I think that the dog's not old enough for that heartworm to have caused irreversible bad effects. So I'm thinking that you possibly, Jenny, have a totally functional dog that can do anything it wants.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Scharf. Support comes from Wild Center, Tupper Lake, New York, featuring up close and personal animal encounters with Adirondack Wildlife. WildCenter.org for details. George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts, family-owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full-service heating and plumbing installation services and deliveries, georgepropane.com. Vision XL Eye Care, Lake Katrine, exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and now new American-made frames, where eyewear is an art, visionxleyecare.com. And Dr. Lucy Chapik, Latham, New York, plastic surgeon dedicated to aesthetic medicine and cosmetic plastic surgery of the face, breasts, and body, a surgeon's hands, a woman's touch since 1996, 518-786-1700. Once again, thanks to Ron Scharf of the Animal Hospital of Niskayuna for joining us today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Kayleen White answered the calls. I'm Ray Graff. See you tomorrow for Computers.